My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document.
Episode 22, a summary of episode 12 to 21 with David Wiseman. Mate, it's good to have you back. I want to just ask you one simple question straight away. We spoke at depth probably a week before in a pub in Kensington, a good couple of hours, and then we spoke for about an hour and 20 minutes in the studio. What was the general feeling afterwards? Was it tough to speak about it? And how have you managed speaking about the kind of trauma you went through?
Yeah, and first of all, thanks for having me back. I think this podcast is really important. I think you're doing some really great things with it. I want everyone who's listening to this know that, you know, Michael and the team who are putting this podcast together are doing it off their own bat. This isn't a commercial enterprise. This isn't self-promotion. This is because the guys who are involved believe that this is important to document, and actually that some of the stories could help other people. So thanks very much, mate, for putting so much time and effort and so much of yourself into this. I do think it's important. So I'm personally happy to support. We did talk in a pub at length in Kensington, because that's just the kind of gents we are, you know, even though we are a little bit northern. Yeah. We can still roll out into pubs in Kensington. Do you know what? At the time of talking in such depth about such traumatic experiences, it wasn't hard. But do you know what? For hours afterwards, maybe a couple of days afterwards, it felt like I'd been in a pub fight. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It was felt like you'd been sort of sucker punched. So I think anybody that sort of takes on these kinds of endeavors and sort of bears their soul needs to know that it's important to do, and it helps other people, but you've got to give something of yourself away to the process. But for me personally, and we spoke about this in the first podcast, I wrote a book a few years back, and I just felt at the time I hadn't been brave enough. I wasn't ready at that time to sort of say all the things that I wanted to say that I believed could help other people, and sort of share those experiences. Because at the time of me experiencing those things that we talked about, those weird sensations and experiences and viewpoints and all that, you know, I was experiencing quite a lot of paranoia. I thought, if I open my mouth about this and I start talking about what I'm seeing or feeling, or people are going to think I'm mad and they're going to take my kids away. And I don't say that flippantly. That's what I thought. And now I'm in a different place, and I guess a bit more mature, a bit further down the line in my own recovery. And I know that's not the case. And I just want to, you know, stress, as you have done and a lot of your guests have done over previous podcasts, and sort of say, you know, you might be feeling that, you might be thinking that, but there's so many other people, mates or people with similar backgrounds like ourselves, who you can talk to, and they won't judge, and they certainly won't take your kids away. You know, it's the right thing to do. So yeah, long-winded way of saying it was hard to talk about, but I think it's worth it.
I ask you because you go back to episode 2 with Terry and he really struggled afterwards. But he was much shot, you know. He hadn't even really started his therapy, so it was kind of getting the opposite. You know, you've really gone into therapy, and you're going, maybe still need to go through a bit more. I don't know, but certainly on the back end of it, where he was at the start, and it was a lesson for me really as well to make sure people are in the right place to talk about it, because there's a lot on me, and I've figured that out over the last 6 months, not just making sure the right people are coming on and the right mix of people, so we're not just getting the same, and it didn't become this echo chamber, but having that right personality and not putting them in any kind of not hardship, but I don't want them to devolve. You know, like, I don't want them to go backwards in any kind of progress they're making. And for me, when we spoke in that pub, that is the first time that I didn't sleep properly. And we spoke a lot more in the pub than we did on the podcast, obviously. And there's some other bits we didn't speak about in that. And it really affected me. And it was the first time. And then someone told me recently about secondary trauma, where people can experience just by talking. I know a lot, like the physios and whatnot, go through that, especially when there was a Headley Court.
Do you know what? I was talking to my physio yesterday about you. Mm. So I don't know if you've picked up on that. We certainly haven't mentioned it before this podcast, but I was talking to my physio yesterday, who was my physio at Headley Court. And I mentioned this podcast. And I was talking about sort of secondary trauma. And he's a guy who wasn't in the army. He wasn't an army physio. He was a civvy at Headley Court. And he had his hands on scores and scores, maybe hundreds, of the most badly wounded guys coming out of the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was at Headley Court for, I think, 5 years. From 2008 to 2013, something like that. And, you know, it really, really affected him.
Mm.
And I hadn't seen him for years. And through my work at the Endeavour Fund, we'd helped to support something called OpSurf in Cornwall, which was originally an American idea, actually. We sort of borrowed the idea from the Americans, and he was going on that, and for 2 days we kind of circled around each other and didn't speak to each other and couldn't interact. And we were, you know, both at the time had been through, shared so much as he was doing his physio on me and I was talking to him. It was like having a second therapist.
Mm.
And I think on about day three of this surfing thing, we caught up with each other. And I said to him, I said, mate, I don't know what it is. I can't talk to you. I can't be around you. It's making me feel really uncomfortable. I can't put a finger on it. And he was like, I'm exactly the same. And he spoke of a time at Headley Court when I unloaded, you know, sort of like the sort of stuff we were talking about in the pub, or like I spoke about at the last podcast, but when it was really, really raw, you know, when I couldn't have a sensible conversation about it, where there was a lot of sort of like tears and gnashing of teeth. And he got that and he took it and just absorbed it, you know. And that's what I needed at the time, was someone just to absorb that from me. And I never appreciated the effect that would have had on him. And when we were sitting there on the beach in Cornwall, when he was relaying this to me and saying that, you know, how much that had affected him, that secondary trauma, I was like, mate, I'm so sorry. But I wasn't the only one. He must have had that dozens of times. He must have absorbed a similar sort of secondary trauma conversation from so many lads. And I just want to thank him and everyone else who's done that. These aren't therapists, they're physios, or, you know, people who are helping us out in different ways, but they took a lot of that and they absorbed it. So, you know, I definitely believe in that, and it massively affected him and his life trajectory.
Listening's important, isn't it? It's something you taught me, actually, when I met you down at the Raw Foundation Heads Together bit, when I saw you a few months ago, and we were saying, like, it's not always just talking about stuff; it's sometimes listening as well, and you don't always have to speak. This podcast has been really important. Your message has been really important. Like, we talk about secondary trauma and listening to somebody, but it's there's that side of things, but then there's also the other side where people will then listen and then seek help as well. Your episode had a massive, massive impact. I think it's more quite like Woody's as well on episode one, where it had such a big impact with a lot of people then reaching out to me after that episode. And so I thank you as well. Like, there's a lot of thanks going on here, but I do thank you because that was, especially when you stopped me through that episode and was like, no, we're not fucking stopping. Like, I don't care about that. We're going to, this is why I'm here, this next bit. And that was the most profound moment for me during the full, what were we on, 24 episodes? That was the moment where I was like, I'm so happy he's done that.
Because well, yeah, we could have talked about Invictus, couldn't we? Yeah. We could have talked about Invictus. You were asking me about Invictus games. And yeah, could have talked about swimming. I love swimming. I like talking about swimming, and people want to hear about winning medals and getting good times and all that sort of business. But to be honest, mate, that wasn't why you'd asked me in. You know, that'd have been a bit of a cherry on the cake.
Do you know what it was? I was concerned with time. Yeah. I was concerned with time and getting to the end instead of getting to the point.
Yeah.
And I didn't do it intentionally, and I was so glad that was that moment. Boof. That, like, and we speak about it. I spoke about it with a few people where it was like that episode was the kind of the top of the mountain for what we'd had so far. It covered so much. You know, we talked about family, we talked about the trauma, the incident was horrendous. There was so many factors in that, your understanding of the brain as well, and understanding what the PTSD is, and how it can manifest. And there's not a stereotype, in a box package. Not everyone does the same thing and copes in the same way. It's so important to go through. Do you think you need, or do you think you'll ever need treatment again?
Do you know what, mate? I was just thinking as you were saying there, you know, about understanding and I don't know, you know, I think what treatment has done for me is I've now got a lot of tools. And I know we're going to talk later about one of your guests in the previous series about sort of the good tools he's been offering, you know, with the breathing and the cold water and the nature and all that sort of business. Whatever works for you, whatever sort of your toolkit is, I think, you know, and I've got a lot of useful tools. So on that, I won't say, oh yeah, I'm fine now, because I think that's arrogant. But I think what's important to note is that PTSD is not a life sentence. It's not like you're diagnosed in 2012, and then here I am sitting here in 2019 and, do you know what? I've still got PTSD because someone in 2012 diagnosed me. You know, it's like anything else. It's like if you break your leg, you know, break your leg badly when you're a kid. Does that mean you've still got a broken leg when you're 20? Might mean it twinges a bit when you go for a run or something. Mm. Okay, that's fine. But you haven't still got a broken leg. If you've been diagnosed with cancer and you go through treatment and you know, God willing, you come out the other side and you're okay. Okay. You carry scars from that, and you know, you might have lost an organ or had some serious surgery. It doesn't mean you've still got cancer. And I want people to think about PTSD like that, because I think we're still stuck in this idea that, you know, if you've been diagnosed, that's you for life, big lad.
Mm.
And I think that's a dangerous way of thinking. Because what it does is it could create. Could create a victim who thinks, well, this is me, you know, and it's like an albatross around his neck for the rest of his life. We don't need to think like that. Mm. Think positively. That doesn't mean that you don't still need treatment, or that, you know, it's not going to be a weak spot or something into the future or something to mind. But we do need to think beyond it.
Do you think doing what you do in your workplace, and I would say that you've got a safe and secure workplace, do you think that's an important factor? I don't want to go into the whole kind of employment thing, but it is
huge,
a big impact,
mate.
In you, isn't it?
Huge. I mean, forget PTSD, let's talk about mental health. You know, and when I say mental health, I don't mean mental illness. I'm not shortcutting to, you know, mental illness. I'm talking about your mental health, that your health, your well-being, how you are in yourself. What you do for a living is a huge factor. And that doesn't have to be paid employment. If you are a housewife, a house mum, and you're looking after the kids at home, be the bloody best mum at home you can be. That's your job. That's your job in life. If you're, you know, it doesn't matter what you're doing. It's what you're doing every day that gives you purpose and meaning and value.
Mm.
And you're adding value to the world, and it's adding value to you. It's adding value to your identity. As long as you're getting something out of that and putting something back, that's all that matters. It doesn't have to be paid. It doesn't have to be convoluted or high flying or high profile. It's what you add value to and what adds value to you.
Mm. That's good, mate. Actually, before we move on, I was just about to move us there, but I just want to speak about Manny for a bit. So Manny was your medic, and I listened to... He's got a different worldview. You kind of prodded me in that direction. His worldview is different, and he was on a Christian podcast. Is that right?
What was it? So Manny... I can't remember if I told you about Manny last time.
You did, yeah. We went... Yeah,
and we found Manny. So Manny dropped off the radar. Did I tell you about this?
No, we didn't, did we? No.
So... Manny, last time I saw Manny was as he was chucking me on the back of a helicopter in Nadi Ali in Helmand province, and I had a hole in my chest. And landed back in England, wrapped up in all my own recovery and all this sort of business. Obviously, when the lads got back off Herrick 11, off from Afghanistan, I'm reconnecting with my team, with Coops and Barney and Coward and all that lot, and asking about Manny. Where's Manny? Well, Manny wasn't in the Yorkshire Regiment. He was a medic. He was RAMC, Royal Army Medical Corps. So he went back to Royal Army Medical Corps. He wasn't in with the team. He went back to unit. And bear in mind, that incident at the police station was his second ever patrol in the British Army.
Mm, yeah.
And then, you know, a couple of patrols later, his boss has got a hole in the chest and is stopping breathing on the ground and all this sort of business. And anyway, Manny's discharged, medically discharged S8, i.e. psychologically unfit to soldier.
How long after was that?
I don't know.
All right.
And he just turns to smoke, mate. He's not on social media. He's not on anything like that. No one's got his phone number. He's not, and it's like smoke. So anyway, I'm worried about him, because all the lads from my call sign are like, yeah, man, you know, he grizzed out the rest of that tour, but it was hard for him. And he was suffering and all this sort of business. So I just, you know, I wanted to reconnect with him. He's one of my boys, one of my soldiers, and someone I owed a lot to.
You had a deeper connection than just one of your boys, didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. But there's all, you know, there is that responsibility of a you know, a young officer or a commander. Even you'd have to be an officer, but as a commander, of these are your guys that you look after. They're your responsibility. And so I was a bit distraught, actually. Really, really worried about him. Years go by, literally years and years and years go by. And then maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I'm in a meeting about another program to do with veterans I'm involved with called Step Into Health, which is all about guys getting out, service leavers getting out and finding employment within the NHS. And sitting across from me is this guy with a West African accent, and he tells me he used to be RAMC. And I'm like, listen, mate, you're not from Ghana, are you? And he was like, yeah, I am. And I'm like, whoa, a Ghanaian from RAMC? I was like, have a punt. You don't know what Manny answered, do you? And he says, yeah, I do. Bingo. I get his phone number off this lad who's just sitting opposite me on at this desk, at this random meeting, and we connect. And meeting Manny after all those years, just in a pub in London, was super hard, really hard. But I'm so glad we've reconnected, and I'm just trying to, you know, keep in touch, keep him involved in stuff. You know, took him out to Nepal with Team Rubicon.
Yeah.
reference Richard Sharp, segue for later, mate.
Yeah, don't worry.
Ain't my first rodeo. Ain't my first podcast. And, you know, got me involved with Kazivat Club, another initiative that we've set up, and just trying to get him reconnected. And he's such a quality bloke.
Mm.
Sorry, what was your question?
I just said his name.
Did you? Yeah.
He, in that podcast, I think it's called something like God Loves Medics, I think. Mm. And it would certainly not be what I'd listen to at any point. I don't think I'd listen to any of the others on that series, but that one, you sent me it, I listened to it.
Yeah.
And it was upsetting and...
Well, listen.
You know what it came across as? Sorry, mate. It came across where his love for you is. I've never heard someone talk about like a boss or a mate the way he was speaking, and that's what it sounded like. It was like there was this affection and love towards you for that shared experience and two things, totally. And he explains how the situation when you got shot. In a much graver way than what you described it. You were dead, mate.
Yeah, no, I was in bother.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was in bother.
You shouldn't be here.
No. Manny, as I say, he's got a different world view to me. It's a world view we used to share, actually. That was a connection, you know. I used to be quite a religious guy. I'd say I was more spiritual now than religious, but by the by. I'd stop breathing. You know, I'd stop breathing. And I've spoken to people about this. And they've asked me about, like, near-death experiences and stuff. And, you know, I'm not scared of when it does come. It's super calm. Even in that environment where there's bullets whistling all over the place and, you know, you're being told, yeah, no one's landing on, big lad.
Mm.
You're off. You're written off.
Are you a seconds, mate?
Oh, yeah. No, I'd stop. That was it. There was no oxygen going in me. And then he sort of picks me up. He's only a little lad. But he picks me up, rattles me around. And then I can take a breath. And then the chopper lands on, and I stand up and walk to the chopper.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I mean, to a religious bloke like Manny, that's a miracle.
Yeah.
And that's how Manny describes it. Yeah. He's like, I watched a man die. He did. And he's a medic. There was a man in front of him who had died. He wasn't breathing anymore. And then he screams the Lord's Prayer over this dead guy and a couple of psalms.
That's right, yeah.
And he stands up and walks to a helicopter.
Mm.
Yeah, if you've got that worldview, that's a miracle, my lad. So that's, I mean, listen to the podcast. I would recommend anyone to listen to the podcast, because if you listen to episode 12 and that ticked a few boxes... It's on a podcast called Battle Scars.
Oh, okay.
Is the podcast, and the episode is called God Loves Medics. And it's you can hear about those incidents from a different perspective.
Right, so we did a HESCO special with Charlie Martel. We're on to the next one. He's a bit mad, Charlie. And he's a great, great bloke. He's a real this was for me was like a role model episode. Someone who's almost dedicated pretty much has dedicated his life to looking after other people.
Mm.
I mean, it takes a special kind of person to spend months and months and months living very frugally with nothing around them, clearing landmines in Africa for the good of communities. Is it a remarkable...
He is. What I thought when I was listening to Charlie, and we bumped into each other at a couple of events... But I've never sort of like had a proper conversation with him. And what I thought when I was listening to him on the podcast is, here's the kind of bloke you'd love to be sitting next to at a dinner party, because he has been everywhere. He's just, he's been everywhere and had kind of the kind of experiences which are just so off the beaten track. He's not been a tourist. He's been a proper traveller of the world, and of countries that you'd never even think of visiting. So the places he's been and the experiences you've had, you know, you just can't fit into an hour long chat, can't you? And what I also liked about this, and what I liked about the whole of this last series, actually, mate, is that first series it was quite a lot of sort of like bombs, bullets, and burns, wasn't it? It was quite gritty, a lot of firefights, a lot of wounded guys and stuff like that. This last series, my biggest takeaway is actually it's been super varied, with the guests that you've had on and the experiences you've discussed. And Charlie wasn't that sort of dash down crawl, fire and manoeuvring type of soldier. He was, you know, he was through and through Royal Engineers, munition clearance, that kind of guy. And it just gave a different view of a different path through the army. And what I admired about him is how he had taken those skills, specialist skills that he'd learned in the army, and then, as you say, used them for fantastic humanitarian purposes on the outside.
It's
brilliant.
It's the humanitarian thing, and I think, you know, the next episode we jump to covers it in greater depth. But the skills, there's this skill base, and people think of soldiers and Marines and all this as like these, some people do, as like thugs and violence and all that. Yeah, there's some of that in all demographics, but there's this compassion, unlike anything, this empathy that also gets developed, especially from our generation in, and I'll speak just purely on that generation. And he's a prime example of it. I mean, the guy's going 5,000 miles by himself,
yeah,
across the Pacific. He's got two little kids, and I said to him, mate, that's, I can't remember if I said it in this, or because we know each other now, and I was like, you think it's reckless? And he was like, no, I'm rowing to them. That was his thought. Like, I'm rowing to them.
Yeah.
And unlike before, his last attempt, when he had to abort it because it was smashed to pieces. This one, I just love that thought, that I'm rowing to him. I couldn't do it. But he's got this mission and this purpose. I'll put a load of stuff on it. Well, I always repost stuff on Twitter and that about him.
And that's his trip coming up, isn't it, this year?
April it starts.
Wish him all the best. Very best.
And he's got some good spot. You know, Hesco have spotted this again, this podcast. And I was on the phone with him today, and they're doing some interesting bits. They're doing, what do they call it? Remote camp solutions now. That's what they call it. So instead of just building perimeters, like walls and whatnot, they're building the full camp. So everything from the kitchen to the kitchen sink kind of thing. They're doing everything. And they've really helped him get this off the ground. And I was with him at the Tower of London the other week. He invited me down there. And actually, you know, when we bumped into each other at the 100 Days to Peace Gala, because he was there as well. He's one of the patrons of the Royal Armouries. And they presented the checks to the three charities that were there, that it was for. And I think it was about 75 grand, wasn't it, that gala raised. It was a good one. But yeah, good luck to Charlie. The next episode was the Team Rubicon special with Richard Sharp.
Yeah, I mean, I've been involved with Team Rubicon since 2015. I love this organisation. It's fantastic. I mean, for anyone that doesn't know about it, have a listen to Richard, to Sharpie. It's Richard Sharp of the Royal Marines, not of the 95th Rifles. Unfortunately, maybe you could book him in.
Right, I was going to put, I had it written down as Rich Sharp, and I changed it to Richard Sharp because I'm a big kind of Sharp fan as a kid.
Yeah, chosen men.
I was going to say Captain Richard Sharp, but I thought I was taking the piss.
Yeah, chosen men.
But tell him, so we'll come on to Rich in a bit, but what was your involvement initially with, because I did, when I booked him in, I didn't realise that you had been part of it.
Did you not?
No.
Oh, mate. I mean, so Team Rubicon, it's an amazing organisation set up in the States. Stealing a lot of good ideas from the States, actually, aren't we? But this was set up in the States by some US Marines who self-deployed, responded to the big old earthquake in Haiti a few years back. They realized actually that their skills and experiences and characteristics of life in the military were hugely transferable to disaster zones, and how they could use those skills and have a really positive effect and be a force for good for people who are caught up in earthquakes, tsunamis, you know, all this sort of stuff, natural disasters. I was working on Invictus Games in 2014, and the member of the board I was working to directly was General Sinek Parker, legend of a bloke, and he was chatting to his mate General Dave Petraeus over in the States, who's involved with Team Rubicon. Mm. Between them, they decided, oh, you know, we should expand this out of the States and bring it to the UK. So General Nick says to me, after Invictus, do you fancy helping me set up or bring this idea across? So there we were, back of a fag packet, scribing on, you know, what we think we should do with Team Rubicon UK. And then all of a sudden, there's a massive earthquake in Nepal, 2015, Easter time. And we went, well, we haven't got a team Rubicon, but we should deploy anyway. Mm. And not only that, but we should pick up the phone to our friends, the Gurkhas, and bring them along as well, because obviously they're going to be force multipliers over there, just with culture and language and all that sort of business. So we joined the Team Rubicon, the American lot, over there in the UK. And I think 2 days after the quake, we had a team of Brits and Gurkhas in Kathmandu, and yeah, got involved with supporting the disaster relief effort over there. Mm. Came back, set up Team Rubicon UK proper, and now that's what Richard Sharp heads up. He's our CEO. He's a great guy.
Yeah, he's we didn't speak about it on the podcast, but we were talking about that kind of the business model of a charity and how he wants to eventually become self-sufficient and not dependent on just a handout and a bucket, like so many charities do. But for that self-sufficiency, I'm really interested to see how he kind of leads that, leads the organisation forward.
Yeah. I think he's a true example of, you know, if you're going to lead other people, you've got to lead yourself. And know how to lead yourself. And he's a guy that sort of has been through a tough old journey in really understanding himself and how his own mind ticks, and how he spoke with such brutal honesty, which I think we're coming to, you know, we're getting used to it on this podcast, that level of brutal honesty, but it's so rare in normal life.
He didn't want to. I think it was 2 days before I spent an hour on the phone with him.
Yeah.
And he was like, no, we don't want to talk about me. I was like, I'll be the judge of that.
There was some punchy war dits coming out there when he was pinned down in that valley.
When he was pinned down,
jeez,
he was waiting for death second.
Yeah.
He was like, I'm going to die.
It was coming.
And then that guy, the young lad in front, just like, let the gym people go. He didn't say that in the podcast, but he's told me, he said he was in face down going, I'm dead, I'm waiting for the pain now. For that split second, and then he snapped out of it. And like when he said, you got to kind of live by your choices.
That's it, you got to, so he said, you know, it's all well and good saying you're a Royal Marine, but every now and again, you've got to live up to that.
Yeah.
And standing up in the middle of a firefight and punching forward, that's...
And they all just went.
You've got to follow. Amazing. But, you know, and one of the other things that sticks out for me in that episode is some dark gallows humour. Of like, when it was a horrible, horrible picture I had in my mind. But I had this picture in my mind when he describes, you know, a company of bootnecks sunbathing naked on the you know, waiting to board the plane going home.
Yeah.
And then the CEO comes out and goes, sorry, boys, one last job. And they're all like, yeah, cheers, boss. Thanks very much. And he went, no, Jen up.
Get back on.
You could just like, I was laughing at that bit thinking
for a month
bite rep. And then he holds that bridge. What was it? with just 30
Brit big necks. 1,500 came.
1,500 Americans rock up. Yeah.
There we go.
That's nuts, though.
That's a leading team we've become.
Nuts.
Yeah. Episode 13, Leveson Wood. He's a bit mad as well. You're mates with him, aren't you?
Yeah, you know, just a cracking... But speaking of people you'd want to be sitting next to at dinner parties...
I wouldn't, mate. He's too good looking.
Well, you know, yeah, true. But at least you know all the girls would come around. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I have been in a pub with him, and it's like being in a pub with a pop star. You know what I mean? It's just, you know, it's embarrassing.
Beth, why are you smiling?
Yeah. But no, he's a good looking guy. He's a good looking guy.
But he's a great bloke as well. So we met really at the same thing, that 100 Days to Peace. Galamini was having a chat. And then you saw him and I said, oh, look, can you introduce us? And off we went. And then within about 30 seconds...
Well, you asked him for a selfie, isn't it? That was embarrassing.
Had my stick out.
Yeah. Can I have your autograph?
Just like that. Not even speaking, just like peering in. Yeah, apparently he came to me, mate. He was like, are you the guy of the podcast? Yeah. The shit got shit work of the podcast. You introduced us, and then within about 30 seconds, he was like, yeah, I'd love to come on. And he stuck by his word. He was mega busy. He was flying around London like James Bond on his motorbike. Came over. We did it in this room, actually. And I was really, really pleased with the outcome of it. Again, that role model. But it was the Afghan stuff and his blasé way of kind of talking about it, because you just don't think of it. You know, he's there with his little rucksack on or his little backpack, you know, going around, walking through Siberia or whatever, and you don't relate that to, you know, Afghanistan, jumping in ditches with mines in between your legs and all the rest of it, and the leadership he showed, you know. And we talk about leadership, and he said that it was leading by example. And another thing that episode taught me was also that leadership is about sacrifice, and the preparing yourself to sacrifice or to sacrifice yourself, not just like getting blown up, but by leading and by putting yourself in a really uncomfortable position. That to me is leadership, that the ability to sacrifice yourself.
Yeah, well, it's one of those values and standards of the British Army, selfless commitment, isn't it? Mm. It's something you don't have to be in a commanding role to lead, but you know, putting putting others before yourself, you know, it's absolutely key. And just the way he's lived his life post his military career, I think he's a fantastic example of that adventurous spirit. And in a world today where, you know, quite a lot of us are risk averse, and here's a guy who's shown at the age of, how old was he? He was 19, wasn't he, when he first thumbed a lift from Stoke to Afghanistan. Yeah. I mean, I think that was an upgrade. Yeah. For anyone that's ever been to Stoke. But you know, he basically thumbed a lift from Stoke to India through Afghanistan. That's just nuts.
Yeah, it is nuts.
That adventurous spirit is to be commended.
Yeah, it is. Episode 14 with Richard Mearns. So I really enjoyed spending my time with Richard and Ziggy's assistance dog. And for me, it was about, or the take-homes from that was like, you don't have to be back-to-back Afghans. You don't have to be back-to-back Iraqs. He was there in the risk area for 3 months or 4 months, but it was a couple of weeks. And the trauma of dealing with trauma really affected him. And this guy is not, in brackets, a pussy. You know, he then went and joined the police and he dealt with a lot of stuff in the police force, but his PTSD kept coming back to a couple of incidents, and it was the dreams and the sleep that were really, really affecting him. And his dog, it's not a dog. I mean, this thing's his lifeline. You know, I said it was an emotional prosthetic to him, and I really genuinely believe that. Like, it's just not a dog. It's part of him. And we went for breakfast afterwards, and in the podcast he's there chewing on a massive bone. But then when we went for breakfast, I went to the loo, came back, and we was chatting and we'd kind of finished. And he kept wiping his finger on in the bean juice and then giving it to the dog and giving it to Ziggy, giving it to Ziggy. Look, like time and time and time again. And then he was like, I've got to go. We've got to go. And I was like, yeah, cool, let's go. So we got up and off. And what there was these lads sat behind us, like nice blokes, you know, but they were sat behind us. But the dog was picking up, he was getting stressed, and he kept nudging him. So he was rewarding him with the bean juice.
Yeah.
I thought it's a bit weird if I play. But he was, that's what he was doing, the nudge, nudge, nudge. And bean juice. Because that was all part of it, you know, like you have to, he's telling him, so he's got to reward him. It was really...
That's fascinating, isn't it?
Fascinating, yeah. I was fascinated by that, you know, just the smell of this dog and his relationship with him. Really, really remarkable. Remarkable. Got to move us to episode 15, Gail Walker, Mary Butwell. What a character. But I'm interested to know your thoughts.
Yeah. So, Marie. Yeah, yeah, Marie Butwell. She was a character, wasn't she?
Yeah.
If you're gonna do, you know, if you're gonna describe anyone as a character, she really was. And this goes back to what I was saying before about this series has been super interesting for me because it's all about talking about people who've been involved in conflict in different ways, not just, you know, soldiers on the front line involved in fighting, but also understanding that impact on civilians, really. I mean, she was entertaining. She really was entertaining. But behind that sort of jolly entertainment were some really dark stories. And I think you had to sort of listen quite carefully to what she was saying to sort of see through that facade of jolly, stiff upper lip Cockney to actually pick up on the bits and pieces of how hard she'd been affected, because she sort of shrugged them off and said, "Ah, well, it never really affected me," you know. But then she talks about how, you know, she could never spend a night in the same bed as her husband. And you go, well, why is that? It's not because he snores, you know. It's you know, she can't have people close. She can't feel that.
There was certainly a contradiction.
Yeah.
And yeah. I don't say that negatively.
No.
It was just hearing her voice and the way she was speaking. It was almost, some of the stories were on autopilot.
Yeah.
But because we were speaking so intimately, you know, when you've got two mics, that's what happens.
But my biggest takeaway from that one was her attitude to hate. And I've got to respect her for this, because she was big enough to admit that she was wrong. As a grown-up, you know, she'd carried this hate with her, and you know, negative feelings like hate, like guilt, like, you know, all those really negative feelings, they're heavy. They're really heavy to carry, and she must have been carrying that for a long time. And for her to admit that she was wrong to hate these Germans, and to be big enough to change her outlook, I think that's got to be respected. And that was my takeaway.
There was a few lines in it, a few sentences, and it was like she was like this Cockney philosopher. Honestly, it was entertaining, and it was so deep at the same time as well. And you've got to remember, this wasn't that long ago in the history of mankind. This was not long ago, and she was a child in conflict in this country, a couple of miles from where we're sat now. And these bombs are raining down, and we can't forget that. And I'm not going to get too into this, but the conflict has affected the world, and this country has been hugely, and this you know, London and Coventry and Hull and everywhere else around this country is still bearing the scars of that. Something not to be forgotten, but also, like you said, that acceptance she's shown and the the forgiveness she's shown is something that we should certainly take home from that. Episode 16 with Amanda Jones.
This was a tough one, mate.
Mm.
Anything involving kids and and kids abuse, it I don't know, it really doesn't sit well. I'd rather listen to 100 punchy firefights and trauma on that side. As soon as you involve kids and being mistreated, it's really, really hard.
We try and get a narrative and an undertone towards every episode, whether it's yours with PTSD and the recovery, or you know, whether it's kind of Walter Boozer Teals with the kind of medical side of it, and then you try and get this narrative, and this one was about really was about living with someone with PTSD and with
their own issues.
Mate, this didn't become that. I had the conversation with her over the telephone, and I was like, holy fuck.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm skilled enough to do this, but she's trusted in me. This is the first time she's ever spoken about it outside of a kind of like immediate circle. I have to tread carefully, but also allow her to speak. We had to edit 20 minutes out because of various reasons and legally and all the rest of it. But she did speak about it, and it was... There's other things there, and it was heartbreaking to think that a child is going through this. And
very difficult. But on the bits where, sort of second half of it, where she is talking about her experiences as an army wife, I think anyone who wants to understand what it's like to be an army wife needs to listen to Amanda's episode. And she talks about things which, if I'd have been listening to them 15 years ago when I was in, I'd have been like, yeah, well, that's just normal, isn't it? You know, like, yeah, you gave birth on your own, yeah, I know. Or, you know, I had that same discussion with my wife before I left for Afghanistan. You know, she was pregnant, I'm going off on tour, you're going to be back for the birth? I'm not sure. Are you back for Christmas? No, I'm definitely not back for Christmas, but I'll try and get Mick back for the birth. These were the kind of normal conversations that you'd have. And that would be normal. Newsflash, they're not normal. That's not a normal situation.
Yeah.
Being married to a soldier is shit. Like, it's hard being an army wife. And, but it's also, it's hard being married to an army wife as well. Because, you know, and she was first to say, she was on the phone, she'd get 20 minutes a week on the phone to her fellow when he was on ops, and all she'd do was spend 20 minutes moaning about the kids. And then he got back and the first thing that happened was, you know, handed the kid and being told, I effing hate him, getting away from me. And you go, hang on a minute, I'm just back off ops.
She was brutal, mate. She was brutal. Brutally honest about...
But that's... Again, that's normal for that community, and you know, no wonder a lot of army families don't make it. A lot of army relationships, it's tough.
That the old, you know, from 2000. Well, you know, it's guys have always been going away, and women now, as you know, they've always been going away. Troops have always been going away. It was also under that, you know, just as much as me, you get away, the Iraqs, the Afghans. And you're away, and quite often, especially in the early days, there was no communication. You can't just pick up WhatsApp, or you can't just ring someone whenever you want to ring someone, especially in Afghan when they were, like Sean and that, they were off out, and they were going out, and like the infantry role, when they were out, and they are out.
Yeah.
but also in that episode, not every army wife is going through the same thing she is, and not everyone with PTSD is doing what Sean is doing, getting pissed up, and there was that domestic violence as well. And I'm mates with Sean now, and I have a interest in that family, you know, and making sure that they're almost looked after. I had a real responsibility with Amanda, and going forward and making sure this story was told, but told in the right way, where it was truthful, but also it was done in a way where we're getting the facts out and it don't become a rant. And she did amazing.
It was.
She did amazing.
I just got to apologise to all the army wives out there who've put up with our shit and continue to put up with our shit, because we do put them through a lot. You know, we do. And I just want people to understand that when when blokes are serving, you know, their partners are serving alongside with them. They really are.
Episode 17 with James Cameron. I mean, I love this fascinating episode. We could have talked. We really, really could have spoke for hours and hours. Beth, you found this particularly fascinating with the Dr. David Kelly. Is that right? Yeah, Dr. David Kelly stuff. And we could have spoke about that for an hour. But his position of leadership as well, with that, it felt like there was a weight pushing down on him. That responsibility, that it was like a stress that was on him to look after his blokes in Afghan. And that accountability towards him as well, like being there, and he went, you know, we went back for the birth of his child, but was just desperate. His mind was not on it.
But like what I was saying earlier about Manny, these are your blokes, they're yours, and you know they're your responsibility, and that's where his head was at. And you could argue and say, well, yeah, but your wife and kids are your responsibility as well, and you go, yeah, I know, but it's that split. It's that split of responsibility, and it's not like any other job where, well, yeah, you know, I'm responsible for, I don't know, getting this contract sorted, or I'm responsible for these contracts. I don't know.
Yeah, like you run a small business, you've got to make sure that there's money, but this is different.
It's that emotional connection to the guys you're working with. They're yours. Their welfare is your responsibility. You know, a lot of their lives and what makes them tick are yours. And you know, as a young platoon commander, I remember, you know, you're not just there to, you know, train them up for warfare. You know, on several weeks you'd wear lots of different hats, including, you know, a social worker, a welfare advisor, a lawyer, you know, as well as an instructor, a teacher, a marriage counsellor. You'd be all these things, and you're so intertwined with your lads and their lives that you can't help but feel that responsibility and that position of leadership that Jim was talking about.
I think it's took its toll on him. That we didn't really go into it that much, which was, I kicked myself a little bit after listening back. I really wish I'd have really gone into that. But off the back of that, Mission Motorsport was coming, and I mean, you know, James, don't you? And that the charity.
I mean, Mission Motorsport is fantastic, we support where we can through the Royal Foundation's Endeavour Fund, and we're really proud to support Mission Motorsport and all they're doing. Essentially, the motorsport, mate, is a hook to getting the lads in. I mean, Jim's super passionate about anything with an engine, you know what I mean? If he couldn't get his hands on a car, he'd race a lawnmower, you know. And but that's a hook for getting the guys in. The real magic is about that connectivity with the automotive industry and pushing guys through from rallying and racing and precision driving and all that, and then pushing them out the other end into Jaguar Land Rover and Bentley and Formula E and all these, you know, all these connections he's got with all these different companies.
He really went into the conversation before, he went into like the Cobsfield housing, Cobsfield employment cluster, and how it's so easy to judge charities, big and small, about what gains they're doing. But there isn't, I don't believe there's any community, like, you don't get all the cancer charities, correct me if I'm wrong, coming together and going, well, maybe you shouldn't be doing that. Best practice, sharing their gains and how to do things. Whereas these clusters are coming together and they are trying to make everything better for everyone. You know, there's one shared objective, and he is a shining example where, or certainly Mission Motorsport, again, it's not about the sparkling thing. It's about the long term. It's about the employment and about providing that security and safety for individuals and families that have been affected by their time in. I would definitely, anyone listening, get on social media and watch what they're doing. Episode 18, Paul Watson. We had to tread carefully in this one. He had a bad, bad childhood. You know, I don't think it came across quite as what it was like, you know, almost constant fear. And we had to tread carefully, and he was totally willing to go full hog, and I held him back to look after ourselves, to look after me, and to look
you
after
you could tell there was more to this story.
Much more.
Yeah.
And
but it's one you know, you spent time in, it's one that you hear a lot of guys who, for them, the army is such, or the military is such a value add in their lives. You know, I remember our RSM, whose brother, him and his brother used to burgle properties, and he was a safe breaker, and all this sort of business when they were in their sort of late teens, and
he went for more, was he? Probably was.
I'm trying to think. No, he wasn't from Leeds. I think he was from Leeds. He went one way, and his brother carried on the route of burgling, and he joined the army. And do you know what? He went all the way through the ranks. He was RSM, and now he's a commissioned officer. And his brother has spent sort of, I think he said, last time I spoke to him, spent 16 out of the last 20 years in prison. And you go, well, do you know what? It's incredible. And it what I got from Paul's was, as I've seen myself, as a young platoon commander or as an instructor at ITC, especially as an instructor at ITC, when it's the first time these young lads are sort of their first experience in the army. And for some of them, it's the first time that they've been told that they're good at something, or that they're a valued member of the team. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And you just see the lights go on.
Well, look what he's done. From what he's done now, his research, his PhD research is about, it's totally dedicated to the mental health and well-being of children of military personnel. He's the only person in the world that's doing this research. Mm. There's no one in America. There's no one in Australia. It is him. And he is absolutely dedicated to achieving that. And he's doing a big survey at the moment, which, again, I'll post on... Oh, well, I do it regularly, post on social media. I could talk about this for a lot longer. I really could, and I could speak about children with regards to you as well and how it's been. But we're going to have to move on to episode 19, Tony Riddle.
Mate, I'm just going to let you talk about Tony because you've got a boy crush on him.
He smells nice. Right.
I mean, mate, every
smells
time,
like essential oils.
Every time we've spoken over the past few weeks, it's just like, oh, and Tony said this. And
did
oh,
I?
Yeah.
Did I
oh, yeah, yeah. Whatever.
I'm blushing.
Yeah.
No, he's a good bloke. He's a good bloke. And he's... I mean, I reached out to him on Twitter, so I think it'd be really valuable. And this was... This episode was focused at you. It was... And I often do it with these episodes. I'm like, what's the question, and I can help one person, or because if I know if I can help that person, it'll help 100 or 1,000 people. So that was why we directed it at sleep. There was one of them things around sleep and creating an environment around sleep. I went to a workshop with him on Saturday, a couple of days ago, last week, and we spoke about movement. We went into movement, spent the full day on movement, and then we went into breath work. And I thought it was all about, and then we did some cold water stuff, some ice bath stuff. And I thought it was all about the ice. I thought it was all about the water. That's the stress. The stress is the water and the ice. It's about how you can control your mind and your hormones by breathing. Mm. I've never experienced 3 hours of breath work, a 45-minute breath cycle. I've never, ever, ever experienced this kind of like wave of joy from breathing. It was incredible. And it was all to do like the Wim Hof method. So Wim Hof's this Dutch guy, they call him the Ice Man. He can do incredible things, control his immune system and all sorts of stuff. I'd anyone going out there who's not even battling with mental health, to maintain and improve your mental health, doing a 10-minute breathe cycle or breath cycle improves. And it's incredible. It was really incredible.
We sort of talked about this earlier. There's too much conversation about when someone says mental health, people automatically think, oh, he's talking about mental illness. No. Mm-hmm. We're talking about mental health. And what you hit the nail on there is sort of like good management of good mental health. you know, we brush our teeth every day, don't we? Well, most of us do, mate. But like, if we brush our teeth, we don't wait until our teeth are black and rotten and we've got honking breath. We brush
some
them
of us
every
do, mate.
Yeah, whatever. Teeth like a burnt down fern to me. But if you, we do that every day. We don't wait until there's an issue, and yeah. We need to get into that mindset with our own mental health. What can we do every day, like brushing our teeth, to maintain a good mental health? Mm. And things like what Tony was talking about, you know, getting outside, getting away from screens, having good sleep hygiene, bringing plants inside, all this sort of stuff. It's all good stuff. And one thing on breathing, mate, what I've noticed of late is every sort of sporting thing that I do now involves some kind of breath and movement. Mm. So swimming, you know, funny old thing, you've got to control your breathing unless you've got gills. Yoga, it's all about linking movement and breath. Karate, all about linking movement and breath. You know, there's a lot of things I do now with linking movement and breath, and it's so good for you. You know, your mum always used to tell you, if you're feeling het up, you know,
take a deep breath,
count to 10. It's good advice then, it's still good advice now.
Episode 20 with Gulwali Patarali. This was an episode that I was adamant that I was going to do from almost episode 5 or 6 when I knew we were going to run with it, because I was ignorant to it. It was self-indulgent. I was ignorant to this and I wanted to know more, and the media sways things so hard. And this is the only episode we've done where it's split people, where I've had comments, not negative comments, but comments like, oh, I didn't agree with him, I could have challenge that, I could have done that, but like, tough shit, because it was his conversation. No one else could butt in except me and him, and I was not gonna influence him in any way. I thought he explained things exceptionally in his own words. I wanted to create an individual out of what can be tagged quite a lot, a big slogan of refugee or migrant, and I wanted to create an individual with an individual story, an individual heartache, and growth and positivity. And I thought he did really well. I thought he was exceptional. And to have the grace to come on when he knew what the podcast... Well, from the outside, didn't really know what the podcast was about. And by looking at the iTunes descriptions, could have been like, fuck that.
Yeah.
I'm not getting not trapped
putting my
here.
Hand in that.
Yeah, I'm not getting trapped here.
Do you know what? I thought it was great, and you know, like you say, it will split opinion, but that shows it's a thought-provoking episode, and it certainly was. And I think, you know, it was important because it's so easy to take that psychological shortcut to dehumanization if you lump together a group of people under one label as you say, as asylum seekers or refugees or migrants. If you lump them all together as stats or a collective group, you can dehumanize that. And it's really important to hear these individual stories so that you can understand at a human level that story of an 11-year-old lad who's just lost his dad. And, you know, his family is in danger because of what the Taliban think of how, you know, his family's interaction with the Americans, even though the Americans, you know, as he said, you know, were responsible for his father's death. You know, it's such a bizarre situation for an 11-year-old boy to take that journey after having lost his dad and family members and then being, you know, his family in danger because of what the Taliban think of how his family was interacting with the Americans and all this sort of business. And then his mother, as a, you know, now the head of the family, the matriarch, having that forethought and understanding of, you know, I need to get this lad out of here.
Absolute sacrifice beyond. Could you imagine it?
I can't imagine it. But that podcast helped me to humanize that journey, whatever anyone's political thoughts of the whole issue are, you can't help but actually be moved by his story, and that helps you understand the wider issues.
Episode 21, Chris Kelly. Chris is a I've become mates with him over Twitter, and then it was really apparent that we needed just a normal bloke who is battling with his mental health. And he wanted to speak about it. I wanted him to speak about it. And I really, you know, like everyone, I appreciate their time. And I really appreciated him coming on. And it's the start of it. I get the feeling it's like the start of his real progress out of it, and being able to understand and manage and cope with it. But busyness came into it a lot. Keeping busy. Did you get that, like, busyness? You've set up about 20 things that are, like, now global.
Mate, I don't do well when I've got time on my hands. Time to think. Even if I've got spare time, that's got to be actively done.
Have you always been like that?
No.
No.
Just me, lost in my own thoughts, is not a comfortable place. And so even when I'm taking time, it's got to be actively relaxing. So it's got to be yoga, or it's got to be meditation.
You do a bit of gardening as well,
mate,
don't you?
Don't get me started on gardening. We'll be here for another 45 minutes. I love my garden.
Well, move us on.
But do you know what I mean? It's, yeah, the busyness, the inability to have any chink in the armour whereby dark thoughts can come in. Yeah, massive relate to that. Massively relate to that. And yeah, I think this, I listened to this one this morning on my way into work, and I was really moved by it, and almost moved by the normality of it. Like, he wasn't talking about, as I say, bombs, bullets and burns and dash down calling. It was almost like you could almost see anyone slipping
into this.
It was
under the duvet, you know, like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, under the duvet for 3 weeks over Christmas. Yeah. And when he was saying, like, his Christmas dinner was, you know, a Mars bar and a packet of crisps from a vending machine downstairs, and you just go, Christ. You know, you can just see anyone moving into that. And that's what sort of touched me. And I just thought, yeah, I felt for this guy. And I had to turn it off. I knew I had sort of, you know, 5 minutes left walking into work. And I thought, if I'm listening to this all the way in, I'm going to take it out on all of my colleagues.
Yeah.
I had to turn it off and put on Shut Up and Dance With Me just to cheer me up.
Elton John.
Yeah.
Best song, Elton John.
Yeah. I had to put on something just to upbeat. And yeah. I just wish him all the best. And I just, you know, I'm glad to hear he's sort of making things up with his family and all that sort of business. And just wish him all the best.
Again, something that you've taught me really, that is that signposting. We're coming to the end now, so it's signposting people. I don't like speaking to people that, no, I'll rephrase that. I enjoy speaking to people, but it's when we've had a lot of guys, men really, coming to us and going, I've got issues. I have to signpost them as quickly as possible and try and get the right kind of help from there, because I don't want to cause any detriment to them. Combat stress, do some good stuff. The Survivors Trust for adult survivors of sexual abuse, really, really, really good. Childline, it's Child Carers Awareness Day on the 31st of January. So we'll be putting some tweets out and stuff to support Paul. Have you been affected by episode 20? Gulwalipasarali.wordpress.com. There's loads of information. PTSD resolution. Go to tonyriddle.com or Google the Wim Hof method. Heads together. I mean, there's almost too much going on there. I mean, I recently had a conversation I went for a beer with the CEO of Calm, so Campaign Against Living Miserably. They're doing some amazing stuff, and as are the Book of Man. But what's going on with Endeavour Fund and all the other campaigns?
Do you know what, mate? There's lots, I'd second you on that, on the Calm Zone, and what's good about that is it's focused on blokes, focused on men, who you know. We're not always the best, are we, at seeing a doctor or help or anything like that, just go and have a look on that site, guys, is what I'd say.
Simon said I don't know if I'm allowed to say this. He said it's the mental health charity for people who don't like mental health charities.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
You know, I push a lot of guys onto Calm, just because I think they've got a good site, some good advice. They've got a helpline, and they've got message chat as well. If you don't actually want to speak to someone, okay, they've got that as well. I think it's 5 PM till midnight. It's on.
So what? Digitally, so you can just
That's it. So you don't even have to speak to someone on the phone if you don't want to pick up the phone. It'll just be like on Messenger.
Yeah.
You know, and it just comes up on your laptop or whatever. So yeah, I think that's a good site. Endeavour Fund, mate. You know, Endeavour Fund isn't, you know, it's not there for mental health or anything like that. You know, the point of the Endeavour Fund is there to support the ambitions of wounded, injured, and sick service personnel and veterans who wish to use sport and adventurous challenges as part of their recovery and their onward rehabilitation. And you know, but part of that is psychological, isn't it? You know, it doesn't matter whether you've twisted your knee playing rugby or you've been blown apart in Afghanistan. Whatever your injury, there will always be a physical, a social, and a psychological impact to that injury or illness. And I just think that sport is just an amazing vehicle to bring together all the impacts against physical, social, and psychological effects. It's brilliant. Get involved in sport. You don't have to do it through the Endeavour Fund. I don't mind. But the Endeavour Fund's a really great place to start and get some good ideas.
It goes under the radar. It's quite humble as well, isn't it? You know, like, until I met you, I'd never even heard of it.
Yeah.
But it's done so much for so many people. It's
Do you know what? I was pulling together the stats. We set up in, we were operational as of 2013. Since we've just crashed through 5,000 participants supported. So yeah, we're doing all right. But it's not us who are doing it. It's the guys like Mission Motorsport and Climb to Recovery, Walking with the Wounded. You know, organisations, but also individuals who are actually doing it. We're just supporting in the background. So
shining a spotlight. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, supporting. Yeah. We're supporting with finances, and we're supporting with advice and connectivity and networking and all that sort of business. So, you know, as I say, it's the guys in these organisations and individuals who are doing the hard work.
I've learned from last time. Do you want anything else to say?
I don't think so, mate. I think what today's been about has been about, you know, pulling together as a summary for the past series. And I think, as I said before, this series has been fantastic because it's brought together lots of different people with lots of different experiences of conflict and the effects of that. Whether you're, you know, an old lady who was buried as a child in the Blitz, or, you know, a young guy who's had to find his way across Europe as a refugee, or indeed, you know, still those crunchy stories of soldiers and their experience of conflict. I think this series has been fantastic at bringing all those together.
We've got we're definitely going into a third, so we'll definitely go to 34, 36, something like that. I was on the phone with Hesco today. They're going to support us a little bit again. We need a little bit of cash to keep this going, and they're helping us, you know. Mate, the guests that I've got lined up are it really carries on. As it grows, the more credibility we're getting, it's growing, and the future is looking good for these conversations and getting that body of work that I've been so desperate to, and everyone around us is, you know, you have been a massive supporter of this, piecing this body of work together. And you know, Des works in our business to keep it going, to allow me this free time. Beth does it all for 500 quid an episode. And it's just having them.
She doesn't really.
No, she doesn't. Sorry. Yeah, that'll be edited out by her anyway. No, all for free. And it's because with all these people around us making this happen that it is supporting others. And for me, mate, we've become mates, you know, since we first met in that pub. And I admire the way you conduct yourself, your humility as well, and the support you give. I don't think there's any finer example than of a role model in the military community, but just in our society, mate. People would do a great service to themselves by looking at you and how you operate. And from everyone here, I thank you. I thank you for today. I thank you for your future support and everything you're doing for our guys, girls, dependents, and all the rest of it. Thank you. And we'll leave it there.